2. Formalities. It wasn't just a matter of shaking hands with the president through a feely glove. The president doesn't come up the space elevator without his staff filling up the rest of it. Then, there were leaders of all the other 7 countries and corporate entities who had built Little Mars, none of whom came up alone either, and the corporation trustees, and another 15 or so who had contributed to the Mars project in some important way. There were more people in orbit than at any other time in history. 115 were stuffed into the Earth side of Little Mars, and the Hilton was as crowded as a Bombay slum. Less interesting food, probably. They all had to talk to us, and they all said the same things. After a while, I could have used toothpicks to prop my eyes open, but settled for synthetic coffee and drugs. Red was very patient, though of course it was impossible to tell whether he was awake at any given time. That's an advantage to sleeping standing up and having eyes like a potato's. The French delegation had a champagne reception that was pretty amusing, since there's no way you can open a bottle of champagne at our reduced air pressure without it spraying all over. They sent us a bottle, too, through the complicated biohazard airlock. And there was enough left after the initial fountain for us each to have a glass. The Martians use ethyl alcohol as a cleaning fluid, but it's toxic to them. Joan and Jagruti don't drink, and Dargo declined, so we three had enough to get a little buzz. Jag would be with us for 6 months, before piloting the next Mars shuttle, as it was now called. She was the first person to voluntarily enter the quarantine. She planned to do 3.5 more round trips, and then stay on Mars as a colonist, stuck by radiation limit as well as quarantine. I was prematurely, or proactively, jealous of her, an unbeatable rival for Paul's affections. In the short time they'd been together in Mars orbit, they had been all business, but I suspected that would evolve into monkey business. She was pretty and well-built. Her figure reminded me of the idealized women on the erotic Indian frieze that Paul had shown me. And she was closer to Paul's age, and would share his radiation-forced isolation. The ceremonial silliness faded after about a week, and we settled down to business. There were 58 scientists and other investigators living in the Earthside, and after discussing it with Red and Green, we set up a simple schedule. They were both independently available for interview for 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours in the afternoon. I would be there with Red all the time, and Merrill, who was fluent in French, with Green. We let the Earthside people haggle among themselves as to how to split up those 8 hours. If they wanted to be democratic, that was close to an hour a week apiece, even with every 10th day a holiday. Half of my 10th-day holiday was a trial, hooked up to a robot doctor who took obscene liberties with my body, though I was allowed to sleep through the worst, the brachioscopy. My reward for being the only one in orbit who'd survived expelling the lung cysts. The interviews went both ways, the Martians studying the humans as intensely as the humans were the Martians. It made the situation more interesting, more dynamic, as a question asked to a Martian could provoke an analogous question from the Martian, and vice versa. Hundreds of researchers on Earth were monitoring the whole exchange, of course, and sometimes their suggestions filtered up. Red and Green worked hard. When they weren't dealing with the researchers on the other side of the glass, they had to deal with us, who could not only ask them questions, but literally prod them for answers. Oz and Merrill were trying to understand their anatomy and physiology. They also monitored us humans for signs of Dutch elm disease. While Moonboy tried to decode the logic and illogic of their language, he said it was like trying to climb a Teflon wall. 3 of the people who would be going on to Mars with Jag came up early. Franz DeHaven and Terry and Joan Magson. Terry and Joan were new to xenology, coming out of successful careers in archaeology and architecture. They had gotten permission to live in and study the Martian city. Franz was an expert on human immune response. He was going to Mars to study the human population. It was interesting to have our own population almost double. Terry and Joan were an old married couple, Joan the famous one. Their status as a prominent lesbian pair might have helped their chances in the lottery. Or maybe not. They weren't going to have any children to add to the Martian population boom without outside help. Franz was a darkly handsome man in his mid-20s. Jag was obviously interested in him, which stimulated in me a kind of primal jealousy. She would have him for 7 months on the ship. I should be allowed to get in a lick or two, so to speak, while I was 50% of the available female population. I mentioned that jokingly to Paul in my morning email, and he responded with unexpected force. I should definitely do it while I had the chance. He never expected me to be a nun for 5 years, or 7, or 10, or forever. He even quoted Herrick to me, the romantic old Areologist. Okay, I would gather my rosebud. Men are not very mysterious when it comes to sex. A touch, a raised eyebrow, and there we were, wrestling in his cabin. He was actually better at it than Paul, but that was just technique, and maybe size. But I suppose it's better to have a clumsy man you love than an expert acquaintance. Or maybe I felt a little guilt in spite of Paul having given permission. I didn't mention it in my letters until Franz was safely gone. I was only getting half my rosebud's pollen anyhow. Jag was kind enough to share. I did talk about it with Red, who straight away had asked whether I was having sex with the new male. Was it that obvious, even to a centenarian potato head? He pointed out that he'd read bushels of novels and seen thousands of movies and cubes, and the young girl falling for the dark stranger passing through town was a pretty common pattern. Trying to be objective, I explained the difference between this and my relationship with Paul, and of course that was familiar to him as well, sometimes in the same books and movies and cubes. He admitted to being jealous of humans for having that level of complexity in their daily lives. He had been fertile 4 times, and successfully budded in 3 of them. But there were dozens of other individuals involved in the buddings, and no one of them had a relationship like lover or father of the bud. "Gather ye rosebuds while ye may," would be an obscure joke to him. Their reproduction did involve a combination of genetic materials, but it was sort of like a shower, or a fish swimming through milt. 6 or more of them would engage in something that looked kind of like four-armed arm wrestling, and after all of them were exhausted, the one who had tested out strongest would become nominally female, and the others would sort of roll around with her, covering her with sweat-like secretions that contained genetic code. The female would grow up to 4 buds, all but one of which would die and be resorbed. It was weird enough. In Terran terms, Red was definitely an alpha male, a big, strong, natural leader, which meant that he was often pregnant. Terry and Joan were a lot of fun to talk with. I was used to the company of the colony's scientists and engineers, so it was a novelty to exchange ideas with an architect and an archaeologist. They picked my brains for everything I could recall about the Martian city. Their research had been exhaustive, but we were the first people they'd met who had actually been there. They'd been together 15 years. Joan, the famous architect, was 45, and Terry was 35. So they'd been about the same age as Paul and me when they'd started out. It was Terry who'd had the lifelong interest in xenology and Mars. When we discovered the Martians, they'd both bent their considerable energies toward qualifying for a ticket. When I sent Dad a picture of them, he said they were a real Mutt and Jeff couple. I guess from some old movie about homosexuals. Joan was short and dark. Terry was taller than me and blonde. They bickered all the time, but it was obviously affectionate. Selfishly, I was glad to have some rich and famous people on our side of the quarantine. That much more pressure to lower it when we came to the 5-year or 10-year mark. The three of us talked with Red a few times. Terry was fascinated and frustrated by their lack of actual history. There have been preliterate societies who didn't have a sense of history going back very far, she said after one such meeting. People might memorize their genealogies, and they might have traditions about which tribes were friend or foe, but without writing, after a few generations, memory merges into myth and legend, though the Martians claim incredible memory power. It wasn't just a claim. They were born with language ability and most of the vocabulary they would naturally use.
No conflict, no history, Joan said. Nobody owns anything or anybody. One generation is just like the previous one, so why bother keeping track of anything? At least until our radios started talking to them.
They do record some things, I said. Fly and Amber knew exactly when a meteorite had hit over 4,000 Aries ago. But I asked him how many had died, and he just said new ones were born. If they were human, I'd say they were in a culture-wide state of denial about death, Terry said. They obviously have individual personalities, individual identity, but they act as if there's no difference between existing and not existing, even Red. But they know how we feel about death. Red could have left me to die when I had that accident, and they were quick to volunteer to help our young people with the lung cysts. We were talking in the galley. Dargo had come in to get a drink and listened silently for a minute.
You're too anthropomorphic with them, she said. I wouldn't carelessly assign them human motivation.
You do have to wonder, Joan said. Where would their altruism come from? In humans and some animals, there's survival value in regarding the safety of the group over the individuals, but the Martians don't have any natural enemies to band together against.
Maybe they did have, in their prehistory, Terry said. Their home planet might be full of predators.
For which they would be ill-prepared, said Dargo. No natural armor. Delicate hands with no claws.
Unimpressive teeth, too, I said. Something like humans. Dargo gave me a weary look.
Both Red and Green are adamant, insisting they didn't evolve, Joan said. That the others created them ab initio.
A lot of Americans still believe that of the human race, I said. With only one other, a lot more recent than the Martians' master race. It was interesting that otherwise the Martians didn't have anything like religion. Some of them studied human religion with intense curiosity, but so far none of them had expressed a desire to convert. From my own skepticism, I could see why religion would face an uphill battle trying to win converts among Martians. They were a race with no other races to fear, no concept of wealth or even ownership, no real family, and sex as impersonal as a trip down to the gene shop. Which of the Ten Commandments could they break? And yet they seemed so weirdly human in so many ways. That was partly our seeing them through a human-colored filter, interpreting their actions and statements in anthropomorphic ways. Give the devil her due. A fallacy long familiar to students of anthropology and animal behavior. But we actually had changed them profoundly, if indirectly, in a human direction over the past couple of hundred years. Red was sure there weren't any Martians left alive who could remember life before the radio machines started talking. And although at first they couldn't understand the noises coming from them,
individuals like Flyin' Amber recorded them all. The noises were obviously important and resembled speech. There wasn't a single Rosetta Stone for understanding human language, but two things combined to make it possible. One was television, which allowed them to connect words with objects, and the other was SETI, the 20th century search for extraterrestrial intelligence, where scientists tried to communicate with aliens via binary-coded radio signals that started with simple arithmetic and moved up by making diagrams through mathematics, physics, and astronomy, and finally into biology and human affairs. The translation was easier for the Martians than it would be for someone farther away. They not only got the messages, but they could watch TV programs explaining about the messages in English. We talked with Red about that. Maybe the others had been listening to us, too. But if they were far away, they'd be years behind the Martians in understanding us. He didn't think so, and gave a reasonable relativistic argument. If they were light years away, traveling toward us at close to the speed of light, then as they approached the solar system, the information would pile up in an increasingly concentrated way. And of course, by the time they got here, they'd be totally caught up, assuming they were infinitely smart. It turned out otherwise.